Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What were the 60s all about? Few time periods in recent memory have been as romanticized, mythologized, and frankly misunderstood as the turbulent years between the mid-60s and early 70s. Now in her early 60s, novelist and memoirist Jenny Diske examines her own countercultural experiences during that extraordinary time. Her new book is the latest in the Big Ideas Small Books series. It's called The 60s. Jenny, welcome to Think.
Hello. Thank you.
You were 12 in 1960, and you write, "I was the 60s waiting to happen."
Yes.
What does that mean?
It meant that I was quite bolshy and difficult for all sorts of reasons. But I was more than happy to rebel against anything that I could think of. So when a period of rebellion arrived and I was just the right age to fit into it, it was it couldn't but be helped.
And for purposes of clarification, as you write about the 60s here, they didn't strictly take place between 1960 and 1969.
No, not for me, they didn't. And I'm not sure that the 60s that we really think about did happen between 1960 and 1970. I've defined them in the book as somewhere between 1965, 1966 to 1974.
For you, there were really, even within that time, sort of two separate eras, beginning with this moment when you looked largely to your wardrobe to communicate with the world about who you were.
Yeah, I must confess, I never have stopped looking towards my wardrobe. It hasn't happened. But I blame the 60s for it, all those wonderful cheap clothes that were available in London. It's true. I think of the early 60s, and this, I think, goes back before 66, say, from sort of 64 on. It's the time, I think, when a lot of people think of swinging London. It seems to me now, looking back, a sort of fairly vapid time of consumer capitalism gaining its muscle and starting to run hard, actually. It was to do with, you know, wonderful little boutiques where you could go and buy clothes that were half an inch long, that fell apart, but it didn't matter because they were very, very cheap. And it was a time when you went to exhibitions and there was pop art. But in retrospect, it strikes me that very little of that lasted or had any very great lasting interest. I don't think, you know, there were very few sort of pop artists, obviously people like Warhol. But on the whole, as art goes, it wasn't great. Not very many great books were written, I think, in that, you know, period of the 60s. So, it was all about style. It was when, you know, Madison Avenue and the equivalent over here really got up and running, I think.
Do you think the lack of really a significant amount of groundbreaking art during that time had to do with the fact that so many people had to sort of experience this time before they could step back and process what they'd just been through?
Well, I suppose everybody has to do that at any time, don't they? I don't know. I think that if you think about it, there's a confusion about the idea of popular. Pop art, of course, is a sort of short version of for popular art. And popular was also things that happened in magazines, and so that one, you know, we were wearing art, and that was very exciting, you know. Until then, if you wanted to see art, you had to go to the National Gallery or the Tate Gallery or, you know, somewhere, and there was art. Suddenly, people started printing art on paper dresses. They also printed Bob Dylan on paper dresses. You could have art, you could have all sorts of things, and you could mix them up together and throw them away. And that was the feeling about that sort of early period of the 60s. It was quite thrilling. Don't forget, we'd been through, particularly in this country, a period of great austerity after the war.
Yeah.
When nothing was thrown away and we were on rations until quite late, until, you know, the late 50s. And the idea of throwing things away was in itself, I guess, shocking enough to keep us going for a while. it certainly shocked our parents.
Well, I guess that the idea of that freedom of your generation to buy cheap clothes and to sort of look to those things to express yourselves was just unheard of for anyone before you. It didn't even occur to them to do that.
No, that's right. And that, of course, is to do with affluence. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to make do and mend. And also, we didn't have to worry about quality. And that wasn't a class thing. You know, people really kind of looked for the well-made in previous generations, the well-crafted and so on. And I think that we quite jovially chucked all that out the window. It's hard to remember now, but just the fact of wearing jeans in any other circumstance than physical labor was quite shocking. I had a lot of trouble, you know, turning up to grown-ups' houses wearing jeans and being told that I was inappropriately dressed.
You didn't
have to do much to upset people in those days, you say.
Well, and you write, I think, very eloquently about this idea that, you know, your parents' generation had fought very hard and had created what they thought was the perfect world for you and people your age. And then you sort of turned around and said, this is not what we wanted.
Yeah, we were hideously ungrateful. but, of course, it's the duty, isn't it, of every generation to be ungrateful. But it was very particular, that. It was a serious and important war. And we were born right after it, and I had no sense really of how close it was to when I was born. I mean, I think maybe that's always true, that the thing you were born just after is more historical to you than you know, the Middle Ages. So they would talk about the war and, you know, the bombs that just missed them in the Blitz and lives that had been interrupted, and we were, as it were, burdened with having to make something of that. And for some reason, some of our generation refused to do it.
Well, I think it's also very interesting because you were of a generation that was, I'm guessing, constantly being told that the world had been made safe for you, but you would turn on the radio or the television and hear stories of potential nuclear annihilation all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other side of it, of course. On the one hand, you know, we've made the world for you. And on the other hand, we found ourselves as young adolescents in the middle of the Cold War. In America, it was particularly grotesque that, you know, school kids were practicing leaping under their school desks in case of nuclear conflagration. But it was, you know, it was a powerful feeling here as well. And it's very hard to explain that day of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy gave Khrushchev an ultimatum, I had absolutely no doubt that I was going to die within a couple of days. And I wasn't alone in that. I've discovered many, many people thought that. Now, that's quite strange at the age of sort of 15 or 16 to have that feeling. So that really does have to be taken into account.
And do you think that led to that sense of you know, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die, that seems to be the way we remember the 60s today?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that is the way. It's not quite the way I remember the 60s. I remember us as much more solemn than that. It really wasn't eat, drink, and be merry. It was more about, can we change all this? And we will change all this because we are going to be in charge of the world. I don't think it was just nihilistic, really. There was really serious politics going on and serious reading. And even, you know, the drug taking was involved in alternative ways of thinking.
Yeah, you write that it wasn't so much recreational as literally trying to find a different way to experience the world.
Yes, I mean, it always strikes me as very funny when people talk about recreational drugs, because we really didn't do recreational drugs. This is partly because we didn't work either. So, you know, dividing the world into recreation and otherwise didn't... It was, in some sense, quite revolutionary, that idea that, you know, that work and play were not necessarily and didn't have to be different things. So, yeah, I think people very, very consciously took drugs in order to see how things were from another angle. I'm not suggesting that we didn't also take them for fun and, you know, but we didn't sort of take them, as it were, to have parties or to dance all night. That's much later, that kind of thing.
Well, Jenny, you talk about not working, and you do mention in the book that it was easy to find a job, easy to quit one and find another. And there was also, particularly in Britain at the time, sort of a different system of welfare available to people. Mm.
Yes, I think that's crucial. And I came to think of it more and more when I was writing about it. And what I remembered about all the aspects of my life in the 60s and of my friends was that on the whole, we were supported by welfare. If we didn't have any jobs, we were on Social Security. I mean, it wasn't huge, but it was enough to survive on. If we were in education, we had decent grants that were enough to live on. And that welfare system came out of the war, of course. And I must say, the more I thought about how our parents' generation, albeit having saved the world for us and wanting us to make good and all that, at the same time, their lives had been broken very often in their late adolescence when they were young. Instead of going to university or instead of getting married, instead of getting a job or an apprenticeship, they went to war. It was a whole generation whose lives had to stop for several years. And I find it really interesting that their children were, as it were, being paid to do nothing but, you know, sit around and think and talk and educate themselves. It was almost as if, on the one hand, our parents were very cross with us for not having had a hard time, but on the other, were sort of offering us the young life that they had missed out on.
But I guess that also led to very often the inability to understand one another's perspective from either side.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean that, you know, they thought we were great or anything, but I think in some very kind of, if you like, psychological way, we were performing something for that generation. And it got out of hand, and they got very upset and worried about us. There was a lot of argument between the generations, but I think that underlying it, there was this extraordinary welfare state where people didn't really particularly accuse us of being layabouts. Actually, that came later too. The whole idea of, you know, students as layabouts happened towards, well, in the kind of early 70s. But at the beginning, it seemed perfectly right and proper that people should be students, and being students, they should question things.
It's very difficult,
I think, to get that now when students are so much customers and so much focused on qualifications for a future. It's so different now.
Education as a means to an end.
Yes, absolutely. But also the idea of students as customers of their teachers and of the universities, which I think is quite pervasive now.
My guest is novelist and memoirist Jenny Diske. Her new book is called The 60s. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call. 1-800-933-5372 is the telephone number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Jenny Diskey. Her new book is called The 60s. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. You present, Jenny, a really fascinating picture of the era of sexual liberation that was really just dawning in the 1960s. For one thing, while everybody seemed to be having a lot of sex, it does appear there was a lot of ignorance about it at the same time.
Oh, yes. I think people weren't very much talking about sex. Maybe they were having it. Maybe they weren't even having it very much. It's very hard to know. The idea was that people were having it. But it seems that people weren't really very aware of what they're doing. One of the most use I was teaching in the early 70s in a local state school in the East End of London, and one of the most useful books I found was a copy of the Boston Women's Health Collective called Our Bodies, Ourselves, which I got as an import, and I took it into the classroom, and I just sort of left it in an unlocked cupboard in my classroom, and I had to replace it every 3 or 4 months. Not because it was stolen, but because the kids just pored over it so much that it just became unusable. Just that kind of simple, straightforward information. It was still, particularly over here, very difficult for people to talk openly about sexuality and about bodies, and the women's movement really over here didn't get going until the early 70s. So the young people I was in contact with, although they may have been having sex, I don't think they quite knew what they were doing or why or how. I mean, whether perhaps it doesn't matter, but they did seem to get pregnant rather more often than was a good idea. It struck me.
And it appears that the whole idea of free love and of sort of having whatever partner you wanted ultimately was sort of an exhausting proposition.
Oh, it was completely tiring. the problem was that if you're acting on principle for anything, it's quite hard to remember what it is you actually want and why you're doing it in the long run. There was a real sense that if somebody wanted to have sex with you, you really had to say yes. And this is a mixture of sort of British politeness, which I think is the basis of a lot of problems. It's very, very hard for people to say thank you, but no. But also a new sense at the time that sex really was not very much more important than having a conversation. Actually, now I think maybe that having conversation is the same importance as having sex. So it's a slightly different. But it was very difficult to be people always wandering into your room, you know, and getting into bed with you, and you'd have to say, you'd have to really, really make an effort and say no if you didn't want to, and then people would be sort of shocked and hurt.
You didn't want to seem high up.
That was quite awkward. It's because these days that sort of thing would be called rape, wouldn't it, actually?
Yeah.
It didn't really come up much then, I must say.
Jenny Diskey is my guest. Her new book is called The 60s. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Bernie in Frisco. Hello, Bernie.
Hi. I used to go to London on business in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and I can remember what the lady is saying about the clothing. And there was a designer named Mary something or other who really captivated everybody. And clothing was inexpensive, and the skirts were short. But also there was an openness in the people, certainly by the 70s, where you could discuss things. And I came from where I lived at the time, which was Dallas, and I welcomed the openness of the London dialogue. In Dallas, you didn't really talk much about sex or anything else, and you certainly didn't go into a bookstore and get caught near the adult section. In fact, there were professional people who stole the magazines and the books and got caught rather than being caught buying them. So London was a welcome release from the strictures of Dallas, and I thank you for letting me express myself.
Thanks for your call. Did you feel like anything, it was a time of anything goes in London then, Jenny?
I guess I did. I did for me. But again, it depended where you went and who you talked to. The thing is that like most dramatic periods, most people were just getting on with whatever they were doing. And most people lived exactly the way their parents were living. So it's very difficult. I find myself saying we, and we did this and we did that. But, of course, it wasn't a huge number of us. But there were places where you could go and, you know, cafes were around. And there were wonderful bookshops in London, that's absolutely true, where you could get, you know, sort of just everything. So, yeah, I mean, it was great wandering around London. There were places when where it was wonderfully free. But it does need to be remembered that England still had the patina of the 50s on it for a long, long time. Perhaps by the 70s it was beginning to go, but it was still there largely.
Let's talk a little bit about that dichotomy between you, who sort of embraced counterculture, and other members of your generation. I was born in San Francisco in 1970, but my parents were not members of the counterculture by any means, which seems surprising now because all we remember of that time were the people like you who were really pushing the limits of everything. What did it feel like when you compared yourself to the what you called the straight people who were the same age that you were?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, we called them the straights. Looking back, I'm slightly embarrassed at our horrible arrogance. But it was the arrogance of, you know, a small group of people who thought that they were changing the world. There was a lot of tension. There were some obvious tensions about long hair and how we looked and doing drugs. I think there was a lot of fear in the people who were living regular lives, and I'm afraid, as I say, on our part, a lot of contempt for people who lived regular lives. We were not very generous, I should say, on the whole. We felt that we somehow were striking out into the future, and you hear it, of course, in that Stones song, you know, the Mother's Little Helper.
Mm-hmm. That was the straight people's approach.
That was the odd thing was that they were taking drugs too, of course. they were taking tranquilizers, and the Stones were singing contemptuously about those people while taking the right kind of drugs. I mean, you know, you can look at that whole period as us being pretty unspeakable, which I think we probably were at some level, but only in the way that the young have to be, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a certain arrogance of every young generation convinced that theirs is the first one to see things for what they are and, you know, be able to affect a change.
Yeah, I do have such a strong recollection of that business of seeing things for what they are, of a real clarity of vision. And I couldn't understand why other people couldn't see it, couldn't see the extraordinary wrongness of what was going on in Vietnam or the starvation in Biafra. It seemed so absolutely clear to me that it was as if I was seeing things in a special bright light that other people couldn't view. And I think that is a young person's vision that we sort of forget about as we grow older. It can make you very angry because it makes you feel that other people aren't seeing things properly. And, of course, they then patronize you and say this is the way the world is. The question is, are you going to hang on to that vision and continue to be angry about all the things that are still going on? Or do you become one of them?
Which do you think you did?
I'm in a state of constant rage. I haven't grown up. I mean, there's a wonderful novel by a man called Roberto Frezzan called Kensington Gardens, which is partly set in the 1960s in London. And he says in it somewhere that it was that generation, the first generation, that really understood Peter Pan and his desire never to grow up. And I think there's something in that. I think we are in some ways quite... We did refuse to grow up, and I have that sense that I still haven't quite made it, really. I find myself just unspeakably angry and outraged by things that I know aren't really going to change. And I think I probably feel that I made a mistake in not becoming more politically active in a real political way.
Sort of deliberately politically active.
Well, in the sense of maybe even sort of getting into local politics, and, you know, just so that one could be more effective. Although, of course, I perfectly well understand now that the constraints on all kinds of political activities are so great that nothing... I do have a sense that nothing really can be changed, but it doesn't make me less cross.
Jenny Diskey is my guest. Her new book is called The 60s. Let's go next on the phones to Ron in Richardson. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Enjoy the show. I was just interested in... I was born in 1955, so I'm a boomer. Just one question and observation. It seemed to me that in the 60s, England had a huge impact on American social culture that really it hasn't had since. And I think in part because it looked like the British invasion, you were having a lot more fun than we were, referencing the prior caller. And I'm wondering, was that a result of the fact that the 50s for England was much more difficult? I understand that after the war, food rationing continued for almost a decade. England had a huge personal price in families with their injured and lost members. And during that same period, the United States, we were blowing and going because our economy was great. We built giant cars and just had an all-around good time. And I'm just wondering if maybe there was a sense in the British baby boomers that they were finally being allowed to have some fun. And I'll take my comment off the air. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Jenny?
Yeah, well, that makes... I mean, of course, it absolutely makes sense. It was a fairly grim, great world that we grew up in. It was very limited. There were ghastly things on the theatre, sort of little neat comedies about people playing tennis and upper-class things. It was a tiny little miserable world, and yes, people were worrying about food and all sorts of things. The odd thing is, of course, that I don't have that sense of, you know, I understand that England did have some sort of influence in America in the 60s, but it seems to me it was quite the other way around from where I was in London. I was constantly looking to America, both for things like music, but also looking to what was happening in America, to the Vietnam War and to civil rights and so on. It seemed to me that's where important things were happening in every sense. So I had a sense that we were just, pretty much a backwater watching what was going on.
So did you have the sense that whole movement was more genuine on this side of the Atlantic?
I think it had much more reality behind it. And the fact is that people were dying all the time. And in England, we marched and we were, horrified and angry at what was going on. But we weren't dying. We weren't being sent to Vietnam. And that's a pretty crucial difference. It was pretty easy for us, to be angry and to demonstrate and so on. I think the reality of America, the fact of the reality of what was going on in America was felt to me a great deal more profound and serious, as indeed it was. Gore Vidal said at quite some point that England's just going to have to be content with becoming, a land like Greenland and Iceland, the idea of the great sort of empire and the it had gone utterly. I grew up without any sense of that at all, and I was looking to America in terms of movies. Well, that's not quite true because the European movies were very important to me in the 60s. There was a great movement of new wave cinema, But on the whole, I was looking to America for politics and pleasure, actually.
You had several stints in mental hospitals during this time. Can you talk about the way people were thinking about mental illness and mental health care and how that sort of manifested itself in your life?
Yeah. Well, I was diagnosed as a depressive and ended up in, well, it started off really quite young in a psychiatric hospital. On the whole, it was, and it still is really, treating of mental illness is very traditional. It was to do with giving people drugs and getting them better so they could go out. I mean, it's got a long history, the history of mental illness, and generally it's been about trying to stabilize people so that they could be more like what we think of as normal. In the 60s, there were some people like Ronnie Lang, in particular, R.D. Lang, a psychiatrist, who started writing about mental illness as if there was more to it than that, and that it was just possible that madness had something to do with what was wrong with normality, and that the mad were in fact trying to, or if not trying, were saying something that ought to be listened to. Now, if you were young and inclined towards depression, this is immensely exciting and philosophically interesting. And it became quite a powerful force, as part of the whole idea of changing the way the world was. So while I was in these various bins having sort of fairly regular sort of treatment, I was at the same time reading all these remarkable books and meeting some of the people who were trying to change this, who were trying to rethink the way that mental health was looked at and how it was treated.
Jenny Diske is my guest. Her new book is called The 60s. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is novelist and memoirist Jenny Diske. Her new book is called The 60s. You can join us at 800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. You mentioned earlier that you were a teacher during this time. In fact, you started a free school in 1971.
Yeah, we did. Quite by accident, actually. I'd got to know some kids in the local adventure playground who used to truant from school a lot, and they would come around sometimes when it rained and have a cup of tea because my flat was nearby. And then one day their social worker arrived and said they're being taken into care on Monday. And they were a single family, a kind of great vast family of about 11 kids and two parents who were both alcoholics, and the kids just sort of ranged around as they felt. And I phoned up some local people, and I sort of started a school because the social worker said that, if we did that, they probably wouldn't be taken into care. So it was, it was entirely happenstance. And we organized lessons and places to have them, and then it sort of grew into a kind of monster, really.
And the way this all came together is pretty remarkable. It was over the course of a weekend, and you found people that you knew, all of whom were willing to sort of contribute to the education of these kids.
Yeah, it wasn't difficult, actually. You sort of phoned up a friend who was an architect and said, can you give drawing lessons and maths lessons and take them out and talk about architecture? And then you phoned somebody who knew French, and it was incredibly easy to put together a proper syllabus and organize, you know, these kids into a school. People were extraordinarily willing to help, and it was a sort of really the local community that worked with these kids, and the kids worked with us, of course. I mean, you know, it wouldn't have worked unless, you know, they were quite interested. Of course, they were interested in it because nobody had ever started a school for them before, or anything that came to that. So in that sense, it really worked quite well. We even got funded by the local council, who came and inspected us and gave us quite large sums of money, really, because it was cheaper for them to keep the kids at the free school than it was to have them in care, which is a very expensive thing to do.
And it sounds like, for the time that it existed, it worked fairly well.
Well, it sort of didn't. It didn't. It was, I mean, it worked in the sense that we all had a lot of fun and we were experimenting. At the time, I was at the teacher training college. I was planning to be a teacher. So, you know, it was, I was doing quite the opposite of everything I was supposed to be learning to do. But reading recently over the diaries at that point, there were all kinds of sort of despair about what we should be teaching and how we can get the kids, you know, more involved and interested. There was such a sense from those diaries of us sort of struggling towards something. And we certainly weren't, you know, working to a plan, as it were. So it was very exciting, but a bit sort of shattering and distressing at the same time, since we pretty much didn't know what we were doing. And, you know, the kids themselves, on the one hand, they appreciated it, but on the other hand, for example, one of the girls, a 14-year-old who hadn't been in school for several years, came up to me one day and said that she wanted to go back to regular school. And I said, well, that's fine, that's good, you know, so that's a good outcome, I guess. But then I was a little bit worried about why she said this, so I asked her, and she said, well, she wanted to be like her mates, and it was only if she was back at school, then she could truant again. But because she was at this school, it was for her. She couldn't truant. She had to come to school every day. And we'd made her life quite difficult, in a sense. She did stay with us, but I suddenly realized that, you know, we were actually asking an awful lot of those kids as well.
How did that idealism and that desire, for earnest desire for change in the 60s, yield what happened in the 80s, particularly in Margaret Thatcher's England?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I have to say that, you know, one day we woke up and it was all not at all as we thought it was going to be. There is something of that sense. I don't know. I think that we made a mistake. I think we misunderstood that we used the word freedom and liberty a lot. And looking back on it, of course, so did Margaret Thatcher. And Ronald Reagan used the word freedom and liberty. And she and I used the words in a completely different way. This may just be ironic and strange, or it may be that in some way we didn't understand to what extent individualism was going to lead to the opposite of what we'd intended. Now, I don't think, and it's a problem here, but I don't think that it's true that the 60s people directly led to Thatcher. In fact, Thatcher didn't think it was true. She said, you know, that she'd come to clear up the awful mess, the awful liberal mess we'd made. And I think that's probably more true. But I think there were periods and areas where we did actually get quite confused. There was, for example, in the area of mental illness, there were people who were writing, libertarians actually, who were writing things like "there's no such thing as mental illness," who were actually basically against all kinds of state interference in anything at all, which wasn't at all what I had in mind. But it was quite difficult to see that these, you know, that they were different. It was quite difficult to tell whose side everybody was on. I don't know. I think it seemed to all come down as a result of the unions. There were the powerful unions that were striking, and unlike in France, there isn't a great groundswell of political interest in England, or even any very much. So there wasn't. We never had our May 68 as they did in Paris, where the students and the workers, you know, came together and were extraordinarily effective, although only for a short time. And I have to say that I don't have an answer to it. I think, as I say, that we didn't take on the responsibility of trying to run things. We didn't become local councillors. We didn't become members of parliament. And I think we let the right come in.
Do you think every generation wakes up at some point and realizes that what they expected to achieve hasn't quite happened in the way they anticipated?
Well, I don't know about generations. I think probably every individual ends up disappointed. I have quite a strong sense of that, really. There must be a sort of some sense of disappointment at the end of every life. And perhaps that accrues and becomes what generations think too. I don't know. It could never have happened the way we really wanted it to happen, and probably just as well because we didn't quite know what it was we wanted. But yes, I would say if I represent my generation, which I don't probably. I'm desperately disappointed with the way the world is. But then, as you say, maybe I would be anyway.
Well, you write that as you get older, we complain about how things used to be and how they are now. Better than, terrible now. And it feels as if this is true, but perhaps it always feels true as the center drifts away from you. When did you start noticing that some other younger generation had sort of taken the focus of what the world looked at and the way things were defined?
Well, do you know, I'm not sure that I actually have. Hello?
Yes.
My feeling, I think that I'm sort of disappointed more than anything else in the young, to tell you the truth. I noticed it, I guess, when I started teaching. Well, I do a little bit of teaching at the university, and my partner is a university teacher. And there's a lack of anger, not enough activity among the students. In the end, I finally gave up, really, on the world when Tony Blair came into power, because while someone like Margaret Thatcher couldn't possibly be expected to be anything other than what she was, Tony Blair as a Labour politician was desperately more disappointing. I suppose he was the younger generation. He's a bit younger than me.
You write that the 60s in some ways were most like the 1920s if you were going to try and compare decades. Do you think there's any way to predict when we might see another decade that has a similar impact or there's a similar zeitgeist?
I don't think there's any way to predict anything, really. But I don't know. It kind of almost looked when punk started as if that was going to happen. That seemed a pretty exciting time, but it took about 3.5 minutes before sort of corporations took over and started running it, and then it died the death. The same sort of thing happens with rap music, I think. I'm not sure. I think that commerce has got a complete throttle hold. I don't think that's a word, but I've just made it up.
We'll take it.
Oh, thank you. On everything. I don't think anything much can happen that's original and interesting without it being stifled. by the corporate business idea.
Well, it is ironic that one of the things you say that definitively was better than was the music. And
yeah.
This week, all we're hearing about is the Beatles.
The Beatles, I know. Isn't it dreadful? Where's the other music? I don't understand it. And oddly enough, now that, you know, that music really is available, you would think very much more freely because of the internet. You know, I'm kind of waiting for something very exciting to happen, but all I keep hearing is kind of drippy girls with sweet little voices singing at me. But I'm probably not listening to the right stuff.
Are you disappointed that the Beatles and people in their position are squeezing as much money as possible out of what they did 40 years ago?
I'm not surprised. I can't say I had held out much in the way of hope Beatles changing the world, to tell you the truth. I wasn't really looking to them for hope. No, I was never, I didn't think any of our rock leaders were going to do very much. No, there aren't very many Beatles left, but the ones that are left just belong to the world of sort of general greed that appears to be the way the world has become. That's the worst of it, I think.
Do you think, you know, so many times we romanticize what took place in the 60s, and your book is a much, it seems, more clear-eyed view of things. Do you think people have a hunger for really understanding what went on, or would they rather just sweep anything under the rug that doesn't jibe with what we've sort of recreated in our minds?
Oh, I think people hanker for nostalgia, and as you get older, it is really pleasurable to, you know, wallow in how lovely things were. It's a thing that I can't quite get my head around, how difficult it is not to do that thing of how much better things were. Actually, I don't think things were better then. I think they're worse now, and that's not quite the same thing. There was nothing. There were all sorts of things wrong about what we were doing in the 60s, and misunderstandings and stupidities, and the fact we were young and, you know, didn't have enough experience, you know, to know exactly what we were doing. What is interesting is to look back and not say, you know, this was great and this, or this was dreadful, but, you know, how was it then? You know, really all I wanted to do with this book was sort of tell something of a story of what it felt like then. And that's why I did it in that form of a memoir rather than a polemic. I don't think there's any point in.
The new book by novelist and memoirist Jenny Diskey is called The 60s. Jenny, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.